Well, unlike the previous speakers, I have some relationships to disclose. I have a son and a daughter, and I'm happily married. So we've heard about inequalities and their impact on health. And if you want to consider whether or not inequalities might be causally linked to health outcomes, the first time this was really brought up in society was in the 1964 Surgeon General's report linking smoking and health. And chapter 3 actually says, how can we infer causality from epidemiologic data? There had to be many studies by many different investigators on different data sets, and they had to be consistent. There had to be a chicken or egg issue addressed. And finally, there had to be biologic plausibility. So that's what I want to speak about now, is sort of review many of the ideas of the biologic plausibility behind inequality impacting health adversely. So basically, inequality produces more chronic stress in lower socioeconomic status individuals. That's the basic framework that I think you have to accept. Now, stress is a good thing for us. If suddenly, you know, we live in Seattle, and I often use as a metaphor, if the building started to shake because we were having the big one, you know, we would secrete epinephrine, we'd secrete cortisol, and we'd duck and cover and do all the right things. And then when the building stopped shaking and everything seemed to be okay, we'd take a few deep breaths, or quite a few of them, and eventually things would settle down, and that response would have gotten us out of trouble. But if we turn it on all the time for not those kinds of acute stressors, it does us in. So I want to speak about the impacts of stress from the intracellular perspective all the way up to the national one, because biology has impacts on all of those effects. So to get a sense of status and stress and what's happening, just think about our current economy and the boss is giving you a pink slip. You're not going to slug the boss. You're going to go home and take it out on the other half. And what's the other half going to do? Take it out on the kid. And the kid will take it out on the younger sib and so on. So inequality produces a cascade of put-down relationships. The Germans call this the Radfahrer reaction, the bicycling reaction, because you put down those below. So lower status produces greater forms of this non-adaptive stress, the kind of chronic stress that we sort of all suffer from. And it may surprise you, but it may not. In a Gallup poll survey, the United States is fourth from the top among all nations in the amount of stress that people report. So in this country, we are in a kind of a pressure cooker. But as I said, stress can be really good for you. So Newsweek had this cover issue on how, you know, acute stress and all the things we do could save our lives. And then some of us will engage in stressful activities, thinking it's fun or joyful. So, for example, I've spent a lot of time mountain climbing and willingly putting myself in situations. So some people describe stress as having a U-shaped curve. Too little is no good and too much is no good, but there is a possible balance. But the kind of stress you want is the stress that you can control. So I don't want to go into the biology of the stress response, but basically, I've already described it. You secrete acute stress hormones that will mobilize blood to the parts of the body that will save your life and also suppress all sorts of things like tissue repair or ovulation or growth that you don't want to do right now while you get out of the harm of the big one. Now, these have impacts on immunity, so you have a variety of impacts there on glucocorticoid hormones, cortisol that is secreted, and a whole host of other ones. What I want to do is try and show you some of these indicators related to socioeconomic inequalities in society. So take cortisol. Studies show that if you're lower socioeconomic status, you will have higher basal levels of cortisol. Not uniformly. We haven't done these studies all around the world yet, but in lower socioeconomic status, you will have 24-hour cortisol levels that are going to be higher than if you're higher socioeconomic status. The same thing is true for the adrenal medulla hormones, as well epinephrine, and so on. Now, the really interesting thing is that up to now, we have not had very good biomarkers of cortisol secretion over long periods of time. Most of us don't want to carry around a Foley catheter for a 24-hour urine collection. You can do this in young children, actually, with bags to collect urine, and that's been done showing what you might expect. But a couple of years ago, people found that cortisol was actually incorporated into the growing hair shaft in the hair follicle. And as your hair grows a centimeter a month, cortisol is incorporated into that. And so you can sample hair, and you can look at the different amounts of cortisol in the lengths of those hairs. So I think this is going to become an important biomarker of long-term cortisol secretion that we can look at in specific periods of time. And it will become even better than, say, hemoglobin A1C as a measure of glucose control. So what do we know? We know that in pregnancy, in the third trimester, you get much higher hair cortisol segments than you do in the first and second trimester, because as you come to term in pregnancy, it's much more stressful. Then it declines after birth, and then it starts to rise again when your child is two. These are some of the preliminary studies. We're beginning to look at mummies and cortisol in hair shafts in mummies, and can't interpret that right now other than to say those data are there, and I expect that they'll be quite interesting. The really important recent study is to look at men who were hospitalized for acute myocardial infarctions and a control group of men who didn't have an acute myocardial infarction, and then measure the cortisol in centimeter segments in the hair and do a quintile analysis. And what you found was the ones who had a myocardial infarction were much more likely to have increases in cortisol deposited in the hair shaft in the preceding month. And it seemed to be a gradient phenomenon like that. First study, just published. I expect there are going to be many more studies like that to suggest that chronic stress in society is associated with more of these conditions that we all would like to avoid. Similarly with chronic pain, there are now hair studies on increasing cortisol levels in people with chronic pain compared to those without it. To look more broadly, within the cell, we now have studies looking at telomerase. Our DNA has repair enzymes to repair the fragmented ends when it divides. The enzyme is called telomerase. So the first study was done, and by the way, some of the basic work received the Nobel Prize for this past year. Elizabeth Blackburn was involved in this, so this is really being recognized. And the first study was done on mothers who had to care for children with chronic illnesses versus mothers whose children did not have chronic illnesses. And what they found was the mothers caring for children with chronic illnesses, obviously under more stress, had lower levels of the reparative enzyme telomerase. This is a US study actually out of San Francisco. Now people are studying telomerase in a variety of different populations, and the results are inconsistent. But what you do find is that, what you do find is that older people who have successfully aged seem to have more levels of this reparative enzyme, but it's not consistent in populations in Europe and other places yet. So I expect at the intracellular level, we will begin to find more and more studies like this that link low status, being down in the socioeconomic ladder, with lower levels of telomerase and the inability to repair fragmented DNA. From a disease-oriented perspective, I've worked clinically as a doctor for 35 years, and so I was always thinking about diseases. And so you can look at a variety of conditions for which you have inflammatory markers, the cortisol stress response, but you can also take a health-oriented biology. And it's kind of interesting that parasympathetic tone, the sort of rest and digest phenomenon, which you can express by a slightly irregular heartbeat called a sinus arrhythmia, you find that higher status people have more parasympathetic tone. And you find actually quite a number of studies linking this. There's a whole host of other hormones, biomarkers, and the like, and I don't have time to get into that. But inflammation is sort of a hot topic in disease biology today, chronic disease biology. And if you go to a doctor, they're likely to measure a CRP, a C-reactive protein, which is a measure of inflammation. We don't necessarily know how to use that information so well. But the studies are showing that lower status people have higher markers of inflammation. So here, for example, are interleukin-6, which is a white blood cell marker of inflammation, showing that the lower your income, the higher your levels of this in whites. These are studies done in the Mesa U.S. cohort. Chinese had slightly lower levels of these. Blacks had higher than Hispanics, and they tended to show a gradient. The higher your income, the less inflammation you have in your cells. This is C-reactive protein, the thing that is clinically being measured, showing the same thing. As a doctor, one of the things that you sort of find is that poor people tend to have they tend to do worse with your treatments. And so you sometimes come up with this idea that these people have poor protoplasm. And in fact, you begin to amass more and more studies to show that being lower down in the socioeconomic status actually affects your biology in adverse ways. And that's not a racist or a Malthusian argument, but it does suggest that by being exposed to the stress of racism or low status in society, it is changing our biology in ways that produce more illness. So for example, here's a paper. I've talked about cells, I've talked about inflammatory markers. What about organ function? The easiest organ to consider measuring its function is the lung. All you have to do is get somebody to take a real deep breath and blow it out as fast as they can. And this is just a review paper showing the lower your socioeconomic status, the less air you can blow out in 1 second, FEV1. And this is a review of studies done all around the world. They control for environmental pollutants, for smoking status, for everything else. And it's really a very good example because it's so non-invasive, and it shows the lower down in the socioeconomic status you are, the less good, less healthy your lungs will be. There's also a concept called allostatic load. If we stress ourselves, we respond. But if we stress ourselves over and over and over again, eventually the spring starts to bend. And so this is a concept which you can operationalize by measuring a variety of markers, such as all of these chemistry markers and blood pressure and so on. And what you find is that as you get older, after the spring has been repeatedly stretched, that you're going to have a higher allostatic load. That is a higher measure of these adverse markers. And the same thing for, besides being poor, also being African-American is a double whammy. And that seems to be true almost everywhere. It's the one thing you can hang your hat on. Even if you're a relatively high socioeconomic status African-American, you're still going to have problems. I think the unnatural causes when the bowel breaks presents that very, very well. What about it? So within the cells, among organs, studies with individuals, what can we say about whole societies? A study was done of comparing a town in Sweden with a town in Lithuania where there were fourfold higher cardiovascular mortality in the Lithuanian town. And Margareta Christensen took a sample of men aged 50 to 59 50, and she gave them a stress test, a physiologic stress test, and measured their responses to it, and also measured cortisol levels and everything else. And the stressor was to recall some anger, to do some mental arithmetic, to plunge your hands into cold water, and she measured pulse and blood pressure and cortisol levels. And what she found was the Lithuanian men who were lower socioeconomic status had higher cardiovascular mortality. They had higher basal cortisol levels and a less good response. That is, they didn't raise their pulse and blood pressure with the acute stressor as much as the Swedish men did, and they took longer to recover. So if they were faced with the big one, they couldn't adapt as well to that kind of a situation. That's just those data. The other critically important thing, and there was a session this morning here on the developmental origins of health and disease, this is the big idea that we're going to have to face biologically in the next few decades, and that is that so much of our health status is programmed from the time of conception until about age 2. Roughly half of our health as adults is programmed from minus 9 to 24. That's going to be the sort of marker for this era. And this is now gaining some publicity. Many of you maybe saw the cover of Time magazine last month, October 4th, which talked about those first 9 months. And actually right now, the man who sort of got the ball rolling, David Barker, is receiving an award over in the Regency Hotel. The so-called Barker hypothesis has morphed into the developmental origins of health and disease, and it helps us understand all the various confusion about risk, about working in the risk factory and trying to treat chronic diseases unsuccessfully. We have to recognize that we begin life in a womb, and we are aware of the outside world, and we program ourselves to be able to adapt to the kind of world that we might find ourselves in. We now have data showing that stress in the womb, stress for you when you're in your mother's womb, is now linked with higher inflammatory markers when you get into your 20s and you have no comorbidities and you're healthy. And all we have to do is continue following these people out and we'll find that they're going to have more chronic diseases. How is this done? Well, epigenetics is the other big idea. And again, I like to see what's in the mainstream media to see whether we're exposed to this by our Median Time magazine earlier this year had a whole issue on epigenetic mechanisms, and I won't go into that. Well, I'm going to stop at this point. The reason I began to look at the biology of inequality was to try and understand why in this country we die so much younger than people in all the other rich countries. And I'll just point out that if you go to the CIA World Rankings website, we rank 49th there behind all the other rich countries. Bosnia and Herzegovina, for example, a country that is war-torn, people there have longer lives than we do in this country, world's richest, most powerful, that spends half of the world's healthcare bills. So we have a lot of disordered biology here to work on, and I think the kind of issues that were brought up by the previous speakers, and especially Lynn Gould's points on how we have to teach about this, they will be our lifesavers.
Okay, so home ownership first. The other part of my dissertation was actually, it used the Luxembourg wealth study data, and I looked at the relationship between home ownership and health in Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. So I first looked at home ownership, then I looked at the value of the home, and then I looked at net worth. And so the gradient for the value of the home is steepest in the United States and the United Kingdom and is very flat. Or flatter, it's not completely flat, but it's relatively flat in Germany. And the difference that I found there is that they have high quality, affordable public housing and lower home ownership. So home ownership rates in the UK and the US are upwards of 2/3 of households are in owner-occupied housing. They don't necessarily own their homes outright, but they're in owner-occupied housing. And there does seem to be some, the literature says there's some health benefit from being in owner-occupied housing in terms of a sense of pride, a sense of an anchor, ontological security, something we can tie our identity to. However, if we are dependent on the vagaries of the market, and if we are vulnerable to subprime mortgages and predatory lending, then home ownership can actually be an incredibly stressful experience. And there's been studies of this in the US and the UK that have shown that it's not universally a positive health promoting experience. So that's a, I could go on and on and on about that because I did a whole section of my dissertation and found that we can't just look at home ownership, yes or no. We need to be asking about the amount of equity that's in the home, the type of mortgage product, how much regulation there is of that market. So for example, in Canada, we've been much more protected because of our sound banking system and because there's more oversight. So there's the social structure again for you. Remind me of your second question.
It's better to be relatively poor, but society rich in a very rich neighborhood. You know, because you were talking about the Gini index, even at high income levels. So
yeah.
Is it better to be the poorest guy in the rich neighborhood or a less than medium income person in a, with every, you know what I'm saying, with a neighborhood where everybody stays on wage?
So are you talking income or wealth? See, because this is where it gets tricky, because you could look at people from the outside, they're living in a beautiful house, have, you know, good jobs, but how much debt are they in? How insecure are they financially? And that's why I'm interested in wealth, because if we only go by income, we're not getting the whole picture of how vulnerable they are to the loss of a job. A marital breakup can be devastating. And in the US, health is huge, right? And it's wealth that can protect. So there's a number of researchers here in the US, sociologists actually, pardon me, who have said that we need an asset poverty line in addition to having an income poverty line. That is, how much in savings does a household need to survive for 6 months if they did lose their job or the furnace explodes or whatever, right? It's that contingency, it's that security. And so, you know, what's been mentioned in terms of the relationship between stress and health, wealth represents that buffer. And so I think we need to be looking at income and wealth. So that's a very non-answer to your question, but but I think if you have someone that's living well beyond their means, fancy house, but if they're way beyond their means, that's not good for their health if they are incredibly vulnerable and put themselves in a, or are allowed to put themselves in a precarious situation.
Yes?
Very quickly, there's a really beautiful, rich literature on the relationship between race and wealth in the United States. We do not have that in Canada, which is really, really unfortunate. Now let me think of the name. Shapiro and Oliver, Melvin Oliver and Thomas Shapiro, have written extensively about race and wealth. And so if you want to look at the racial disparities in income and then look at the racial disparities in wealth, it's truly mind-blowing how much inequality of wealth there is when we look at racial differences as compared to income. And there's a good literature as well on the targeting of subprime mortgages and predatory lending at African-American communities. So there's a very, very in-depth literature on that that I would highly recommend that you dig into. It's really good.
Anybody else on the panel want to address that question? Or?
Actually, just in terms of your question about would you be better off being less rich, when you look at income rather than wealth, studies in the United States show that you would be that the rich would live longer if they lived in a lower, if they were less rich in a lower income gap state. So we have those studies, and they're individual. They're ecological studies.
First, I just want to thank you all. This is brilliant. Thanks for being here. It's really great. My name is Stephen. I'm from the University of South Florida, Masters in International Global Health Practice. I didn't catch your name, and I apologize. It's a young woman who talked about, you know, the relationship of sickle cell.
Yes.
However, I do have a question regarding that. It seemed the conclusion, you know, just to refresh, we said, one, stop assigning race to sickle cell, or, you know, race to the disease. And then we said, two, you know, we want distributive justice. Is that how you worded it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as in order? It should be done like that, executed like that? Or because I'm just concerned, and I question this. I mean, those are both very important things to do, paramount importance. However, I feel many people who don't carry dialogue, you know, regarding race and all this, will get really confused when we say, oh, we need to, you know, de-assign race from this. But we also want to, you know, address this injustice. So can you maybe speak to that?
Sure.
I think it's very hard to disassociate race from sickle cell disease based on the very brief timeline I presented. There have been lots done in terms of what's being done, what had been done historically in the United States looking at sickle cells that attached it to black people. And so I think that we have to continue to have these conversations about the fact that it's a biological disease and that by focusing these talks of inequity solely on the black race, we're doing a huge disservice. To answer your question about the ordering, I don't think it necessarily needs to be done in that order, but sickle cell is so far behind in terms of having a real conversation, in terms of coming to the table and having a real voice. I happen to work in the Division of Blood Disorders, and so I see other models. I see a hemophilia model that thrives. I see a diamond black fan anemia model that thrives, and it's because the voices are not at the table. And so if we're maybe able to disassociate race a little bit and say that this affects a larger population pool, we may be able to get something a little bit more than if we continue to house it in the race conversation. Back there.
Thank you for asking that question. We're struggling right now with what we want to put into the Train the Trainer program. We've been training health departments, and they've been asking for a different type of curriculum than a community center would, than would high school teachers. So I think we're going to have to, if we get people that are interested in that, then we'll design the curriculum. We'll probably be writing people and you know, sending out a survey and asking them what they need to learn in a train-the-trainer program. And so we're really interested in any ideas that you have if you want to share what the needs are out there around racism and curriculum. I mean, we've been, like, when we were training at Whatcom County Health Department or at Seymour Community Health Centers, which is a Latino center, we were, I mean, our racism curriculum was different than it would be at Seattle Girls School. What was the other question?
What's the future of the JHA in terms of future education programs or curriculum?
we develop curriculum all the time. I've been thinking a lot about now we need to develop more curriculum on classism and sexism. Now that we've, you know, we're not finished with the racism curriculum, we could totally have 20 or 25 lesson plans, quite frankly. We could write a whole book on it. So we're just, when we just apply for grants. When a grant comes through and someone gives us some money to develop more curriculum, that's what we do. So.
Okay. So I guess, you know, one of the questions I had, Stephanie from Toronto.
Thank you.
And my boss is in the room, so I'll try to keep it PR. So one of the questions I had was, how do you sort of deliver this curriculum to young ladies at Seattle Public School? What institutionalized supports are there to help enact the curriculum? That's number one. And question number two, a little bit personal, but you know, communities that have been highly marginalized or been treated in a racist manner may have some issues with your whiteness, right? So how do you broach that issue going into those communities?
Thank you. Those are excellent questions. Okay, so I'm going to answer the second question first. I've been doing a lot of undoing racism type of training myself to really work with this process of being able to explicitly discuss racism being a white person. And I try to describe myself as a white ally, but I recognize that I can't begin to understand what issues people are being exposed to around racism. But one of the other things that we do, and it's part of our empowerment pedagogy, is that when we go in and train, for example, when we were doing the environmental justice training, part of our contract was immediately passed over to co-teach with someone who was from the community. And she was Latina. So basically, I developed the curriculum, and then she reviewed the curriculum and helped me rewrite it to be more culturally competent working with the community. And so that was really, really helpful, and that's basically part of our pedagogy. So at Seattle Girls School, we do the same thing. We do a capacity increasing, and we just hand off part of our contract to do that. What was the first question again? So Seattle Girls School is a really, really interesting school because 40% of the, more than 50% of the students are people of color, and more than 40% are on full scholarship. And they have a race, a battling racism mission statement. We've been working there since 2004. So every time we develop some, originally when we were developing curriculum with them, it was for free. And now we have a reputation with them. So what we just go in and tell them the new curriculum that we want to develop, and then they just let us in. So our next one is on immigration. But I'm not quite sure how to answer your, the racism, I have to tell you, back to the first part of your question about racism, one of the interesting things that we've had with all of our students going up to age 25, age 30, and dealing with racism, and me being white, is how do you deal with this power of hopelessness when you all of a sudden start reviewing all of this literature that you're not gonna live as long, or that you're gonna have chronic diseases, or you're gonna have these issues because you've been racially discriminated against. And so we've had to actually work some new pieces into our empowerment pedagogy to work with people who are feeling this hopelessness. And it's actually the sixth graders that I was working with at Seattle Girls School, they're great. They're super empowered, and they feel like they can change themselves and the world around racism. But people in the 20s and 30s, it's much, much harder, and we're really working on this.
And I think the thing to add to that is that there has to be an analysis, not just of empowerment, but how do we turn the anti-oppression notion on its head, right? And say, well, if, you know, privilege is equated by a good job, you know, you can't change the color of your skin, but you can certainly enhance some of your characteristics, right, your education levels to sort of commiserate with what is seen as privilege, right? Like, and taking that compulsive notion out, because I think that's where a lot of people get stuck, right? And so we have to turn sort of anti-oppression on its head and sort of allow for people to sort of do the things that are going to make them
No, but thank you. And I have to tell you, my Seattle Girls School girls are all over that. They're pretty impressive.
Belinda.
My question is of Dr. Vezrushka. I'm sorry, I'm mangling your name. My name is Shobha Srinivasan from the National Cancer Institute. I grapple a lot with stress and the biological measures of stress. So we know in mice, for example, that if you stress them, the transgenic mice, which kind of develop cancers, you stress them, they develop these tumors. The tumors grow at a faster rate, but they don't develop the tumors earlier.
It's an extremely important question because we live in this very stressful society. It's very hard to, you know, perceived stress is, you know, you do questionnaire surveys and you can do rankings like that. But a lot of us internalize a lot of stress. And one thing I think I failed to mention is that health is transmitted intergenerationally and wealth is transmitted intergenerationally. And if we, you know, I mentioned the mummy hair samples. We're now going to Peruvian mummies and getting these hair samples. I wouldn't be surprised if we were able to find some hair from hunter-gatherers in prehistory that maybe they had lower cortisol levels because the stress was really a very different form. You know, they got out of trouble when the beast was charging, and the rest of the time it was relatively leisure time society. I think it might be, you know, I've lived in primitive societies for a long period of time, and these people who didn't know that they were low socioeconomic status because they were isolated, the word stress didn't even exist in their language. And now in so many languages in the world, they speak of, in Nepali they call it e-stress, and in Japan, stressoru. You know, they've adopted the sort of American term. I would bet that, you know, Japan is a very stressful society, yet it's the longest lived in the world. And so stress doesn't seem to be having the same adverse impacts in Japan as it does here. What's the difference? I haven't lived in Japan to be able to relate, but I collect a lot of stories. And one is a story of an American teaching English there who's stuck in a traffic jam for about 2 hours, and he's just fuming. Meanwhile, the cars next to him, you know, they're sort of laughing, and they brought out some food, and they're just enjoying being stuck together because they're all together in it. And so in Japan, everybody shares the same stress. But here, if you're a rich man and you have a problem, my friend Raymond calls it the check principle. He just writes a check and something gets done. And if you're, you know, if you're a high-level person and you're having a bad day, you don't have to come into work and you won't lose your job. I mean, you give the stress. You're not the one who takes it. So stress has to be seen within the context, and I don't think we've begun to address that because there's no good way to measure stressors. We can begin to measure the impact of stress on a human body, but I would suggest that one form of stressor that I see here is people walking around with these little devices that they're constantly playing in. They don't look happy. They don't look unstressed. And so I'm trying to avoid that and stick with my relationships.
Gentleman in the back.
Not the hair chef cortisol stuff yet, but in the area under the curve, 24-hour cortisol collections, yes, that appears to be related to perceived stress. Sheldon Cohen in Pittsburgh, he takes a variety of people and inoculates them with cold virus. And the lower socioeconomic status people get more colds, people under more stress get more colds. What he also finds, and this is the intergenerational thing, if your parents owned a home for longer or owned a home at all, you're less likely to get a cold than if they rented. These are people in Pittsburgh. So, this is going to become very, very complex, and I would think that if health is transmitted intergenerationally, and the African Americans in the United States have suffered all the consequences of slavery and the intergenerational transmission of that, I think that is part of the reason, and there's some studies now on this, to suggest that that's why health outcomes for African Americans continue to do poorly despite whatever we try to do to ameliorate that, and that's because of the legacies of slavery. We can demonstrate intergenerational transmission for 3 to 4 generations. If 3 or 4, why not 10 or 20?
I think we'll take one more question and then we'll end our session. So the young woman there.
Well, I mostly try to teach about these ideas, and I follow the studies, so I'm probably not a good person to ask that. I was at a conference in Iowa City a couple of weeks ago, and I talked a little bit about stress, and they're all faculty people in the university, and somebody made the comment that people have been teaching for long periods of time that undergraduates now were under constant stress. They seem to have no periods. Everybody was just sort of in a stressful frenzy, and a lot of heads shook. Agreed when this person brought that up, and if I think about my daughter right now, I mean that's all she ever talks about is how stressful everything is, and I mentioned the Gallup poll survey showing the United States has the 4th highest level of stress. I can see that Afghanistan and Iraq would be higher, but why should we have all this stress if it isn't imposed by wealth disparities or income disparities or incredible insecurities that we face right now? But how to study stress in the environment that way? It's an unresolved question.
So thank you again for coming to the Socialist Caucus Premier.